Today we're going to talk about value. What is value? It's a problematic word just by itself. Toby, what do you think value is?
Oh, that was sneaky. I was hoping to be able to sort of go, Kim, please tell me about value because it has me super confused. And you put me on the spot right off the bat. Thanks for that, I suppose.
You're welcome.
So what is value? I tend to come back to, I think I learned this from Jerry Weinberg, one of his writings, or that's on quality, but he sort of says quality is value to some person, and then you need to dive into what is value, and then sort of, well, it's obviously something that is valued, so it's that, but what does have value, and what is valuable? I just tend to sort of get really caught up in trying to figure out, okay, but how do we even gauge it? Because so much about what we do is focused on business value or some other value, and in my dark days, I tend to sort of frame the current agile movement as valuing value, or sort of we value valuing value, but what is it even? It's obviously something that we desire, something we want more of, something that we, in a sense, think that we could trade for other things.
Yeah, and sometimes it's easier to talk about what it's not. So one of the things that I always think about with value is quite a materialistic one. So if you think about objects, especially art type objects or things like stamps, I mean, stamps are literally a piece of paper that someone might have licked years ago with a picture on it. You may go to a shop and buy it. A stamp as a collectible, but once you get it in your hands, it's not actually worth anything. It has no value until at some point in the future you may decide to sell it. And then we can say it has a materialistic value of X, which is what the person who wanted to buy that stamp was prepared to pay for it. So that's sort of like the very simple materialistic view of what value is. But I don't think that's what we mean when we talk about value in the agile sense. I think there is an element of it, but that's why it's so hard to put your finger on it. Because while you've got something in your hands, until someone trades something for it, you don't actually know what its value is.
Yeah, it's part, does it have utility? Sort of, we value things that has utility to us. And the materialistic view is sort of, we value it in accordance to either what we would give up or what we could trade it for, in a sense. So it has that sort of, the value of the thing is, it's what we could substitute it for. But it also becomes so highly contextual, I think. And one thing that I've been thinking a lot about recently, partly due to how sort of observing the conversations about more distributed ways of working and sort of how do you do locally adjusted compensation, stuff like that. How do you handle that? It's a tricky issue. I probably won't go into that too much. But looking at that, you can really quickly get a sense that this disconnect between the value of a thing or our work and how it's valued. And a market actually pays in accordance to how it's valued, not in accordance to some intrinsic value of the thing. And that's, I think that's where you're sort of, well, it's a licked piece of paper. That's sort of, yes, or it's a collector's stamp. And that's the relationship between the thing and the anticipation of utility or status or uniqueness someone has to it. And another way to sort of think about that, I think, is very well captured by the origins of fire departments. Or the first fire brigade was a private organization.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard this story?
I don't think I have.
Okay, so it's super interesting because there was this Roman chap, I don't remember his name, but he has this brilliant idea that he started a fire brigade. And what they did was essentially they waited for something to catch fire,
mm-hmm.
a fancy house usually. And then you sort of take your fire truck or the equivalent they had, and you go there and go, okay, we have water, we have men, we can put the fire out. The only thing you need to do is to sell the house to me cheaply.
Oh, really? Is that how it worked?
That's how he made a fortune.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're the one owning a now burning house, you have sort of two options. You either let it burn, and you have the value of your burnt down house, or you take the offer that he gives you, which is lower than the value your non-burning house had, but probably higher than the value of your burnt down house.
Yes.
So quite a lot of people then took him up on his offer. Today, we would think that this would be slightly ethically debatable. So that's probably why we figured out how to socialize this service to a certain degree. But it does say something about how we value a service or a goods is very contextual, and how there's leverage in understanding the situation that governs these things.
Yeah, so I do like the idea. It's also quite subjective. So back to the stamp example, yeah, it's a licked piece of paper to one person and it's a highly valuable collectible to someone else. It's all in the eyes of the beholder. And the same with the story about the Roman houses burning. It's the eye of the beholder. What is the value of the thing? So when it's so subjective, how can we use it as an input to decide which piece of work we should do first when we're trying to deliver agile stuff? That's the trick, right?
Yeah, because we often hear you should prioritize by value in some sense. And then you end up in the governance problem of who gets to decide what the value is. What is business value? What's the value of that feature? What's the value of a customer? What's the value of the thing being operational?
Yeah, and how will it be valued by the person that's going to ultimately use it at the end?
Yeah. And that's, I ran into that problem fairly early on in my agile adventures where I was working on this project and I wanted to ensure that we had a continuous delivery pipeline. So this was way back in 2007, 2008. So long, long time ago, continuous integration was a new and odd thing at the time. And I wanted to set this up and I wanted us to sort of show that we could deploy the software into production on a recurring time period. And the thing is that they just went, but why would we want to do that? It's not supposed to be go into production for 18 more months. And I, of course, I was young and I got really, really confused because I was standing there going, well, I think there's business value in knowing that you can deploy. And the stakeholders, they just sort of looked at me with the same complete lack of understanding going, but of course it will be deployable. And of course we had massive problems trying to deploy the thing 18 months later because there was a lot of hidden assumptions regarding the infrastructure that just didn't pan out. Everything from versions to scalability to provisioning to all of these things. We couldn't get the thing on machines even. But we couldn't agree on what even constituted value in that point. The sort of that being able to actually deliver had value. We couldn't even agree on that. And I think that's the problem when we start discussing value or sort of prioritize by value. Yes, but who decides what's valuable then? And then you end up just sort of whatever is valued by some person.
Actually, you've just reminded me of a story which is actually an easy one from a value perspective. And I can't remember the whole context and probably shouldn't be sharing the whole context, but I remember a discovery piece that we were doing, which was to kick off a project. And the business sponsor was able to come in and articulate, if you can solve this problem on this particular web page, that will mean that it will result in this many more sales per day. And it was a significant amount. And so what it meant is if we could bring that piece of work in weeks and prioritize it so that it got done and implemented, then as soon as it was implemented, we'd suddenly start seeing the benefits, and they were material, money, easy to count benefits. So that's the kind of the opposite end of the scale. That was a super easy one to be able to say, what is the value of doing this work? Oh, here you go. It's a dollar value, which we're currently missing out on every single day that we're not doing it. So that was actually super easy to do.
That's great. How do we get more of those instances? What would it take in order for us to have that more broadly? I don't think we should have it absolutely, but in more instances than we usually tend to have.
Yeah, because numbers drive weird behaviours. I'm actually starting to be a really big fan of the A3 process. I'm finding it quite a flexible way to articulate the numbers, the numerical aspects of problems or issues or things that we want to try and resolve, and then also articulate the numbers related to the various countermeasures we want to do. So I don't know if a lot of our audience will know what the A3 process is. Toby, do you think it's worth us going through that?
I was just thinking, can you just run through how the A3 process work and with a focus with how you would use it in an instance like this?
Sure. So the A3 process comes from the size of paper being A3. And when you fold an A3 piece of paper in half, you get two A4 pieces, which is really cool. Okay. And what that was originally used for was in Lean or Toyota Production System for understanding the root cause of problems and being able to understand the ways that those problems could be addressed, which are called countermeasures in the A3 process, so that they could make trade-offs and decide which things to do first to address some of the problems and issues they'd found. But the trick with the A3 process is you don't think about how am I going to solve this problem. It's our natural human tendency, right? We go, oh, I've got a problem. problem, or we go, we only need to do this, which is actually just providing a proposed solution without articulating what problem it solves. So in the A3 process, on the first half, so the first A4 sheet, you only focus on that to start with, and you go and investigate the problem. You talk about the background, you talk about the current context, you talk about the goals and targets, and you also articulate what analysis you've done. And you keep going backwards and forwards between all of those different boxes. And what you end up with by the end of that process is a beautifully crisp statement, because you've gone and spoken to a whole bunch of people and got their input. And you've got a nice statement that says, here's what the scope is that we're trying to address. And here's what the current issues are. And here are the goals and targets. And they're things like, at the moment, we have this problem happening this many times a day, and it would be acceptable if it only happened that many times a day or not at all, right? So what are the acceptable number we want to get it down to? And then below that is the analysis. This is all the evidence that says, yes, it is that number, and it really does happen that many times a day, and here's the impact of it happening that many times a day. Then once you've got that beautifully written set of statements, then you go to the second half. And the second half is where you pose what are called countermeasures. And countermeasures is a great term, because what we really want to do when we see a problem is we want to solve it forever. And the idea of a countermeasure is it recognizes that nothing lasts forever. So your countermeasure at some point will become ineffective. It might be 500 years, it might be 5 minutes, but at some point it will become ineffective. And by calling them countermeasures, not solutions, that opens up our mind to think about things that aren't necessarily going to what we would have called solve it, but will start to address the issue or the problem. So you start to, you go around to people and you go, here's this beautifully written set of statements about what the problem context is. What are some of the things that we could do to address it? And you start to write all of those down. And when it's done well, you get to a point where you can say, here's what the problem is. Here's how much we want to reduce it by. Here are all these countermeasures. Here's how much investment in effort or money or time or whatever is required in order to do those countermeasures. And here's how effective they're likely to be. Or we've tested them and we found that they were effective in this way. And it's not very hard by the time you get it that crystal clear to go, oh, well, we should do out of three countermeasures this one here, because even though it's not going to solve it to the point that we really want it to, it's not going to cost as much as the options which would, and it's still going to be good enough. So where it relates to value is, unless you can articulate the problem that you're trying to solve very clearly, and by solving that, what impact that would have, it's very hard to know the value of the things that you're proposing to do to address those problems. So that's why I like the A3 as a framework, as a way of articulating it.
Let me just checkpoint that so we can sort of ensure that we have some sensible amount of shared understanding here. So what I'm hearing here is that the key insight here is partly that if we use a structured method to sort of clarify our current situation, or at least how we see it, and we collect the evidence for it by going back and forth, we can sort of iterate on the problem statement, we can sort of collect the data that supports the evidence for our assessment, essentially. We can sort of find the countermeasures, both sort of how do we start moving the situation in the here and now, and how do we move to some form of solution. Then we can also fairly easily, given that we've done all this, we end up in this situation where you end up with essentially the saying that a problem well defined is half solved. In this sense, it's once you actually reached and here's my proposal for what we ought to be doing, that is almost obvious, because the iteration and the debate and the trade-offs has happened within that structured process already of sort of defining the problem and refining the potential countermeasures. Would that be a fair account of that?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's a really nicely structured way to get to the crisp, here's what the thing is. And so instead of sort of rushing in, flapping your hands, going, we need to do more of this, which is, you know, your proposed countermeasure. What you've done is you've taken people on the journey as you've developed the problem statements. And so by the time we need to do more of this, everyone's on board with it.
Yeah, so is the A3 and the A3 process, because I think it's a thinking process, it's a disciplined process that happens to create a nice artifact. Is the value of it that it also shows the journey? It doesn't only show your intuitive solution or sort of, it actually helps both you and everyone else. You can bring people on the journey because you have a structure that everyone can sort of follow, because it's logical and it's repeated and you're supposed to do these multiple times. So you can sort of, you don't only have the, here's the decision, you also have then how, here's how we came to that decision. In a sense, it becomes, for lack of a better word, it becomes an accountability instrument too. Because not that you're sort of responsible for the outcome, but you can make accounts for how you came to that decision. So it helps build that mutual understanding of that, which I think is, that seems to be a huge added value of just going through these structured steps.
Yeah, and the other thing about having any sort of framework, so a lot of the questions that you would ask because of the A3 framework, so the questions related to the background, the context, the problems, the analysis, because they're on a bit of paper and you're filling in a box, it's actually giving you permission to ask those questions in a very polite way. Whereas if I just kind of wandered up to someone and go, but why is it a problem? And how many times does it happen? And why does it happen? And you know, what impact does it really have? If you just ask that cold without having this template to fill in, a lot of people would get put offside just by you asking that question. But the minute you've got a template and you're trying to fill in the boxes, it actually makes it a much easier and more polite conversation because people can see the intention of why you're asking it.
So it slightly externalizes, it gives context to why you're actually asking that question. You're not sort of just asking for asking's sake, you're actually trying to accomplish something. I think personally, one huge thing it changes when I get a question for this particular reason, that if I get a question where someone has the intent to write it down, in this case, they're standing there with their A3, sort of, what are the numbers here? That just slight sense of permanence also feels like, in a sense, my time, my response is more valued because you're doing something to it. You're collecting it and you're sort of putting effort into it too, which sort of enhances the value, which actually increases my engagement in actually giving a good answer to it too. So that's interesting. I hadn't actually thought about that explicitly before.
Yeah, the minute you've got like a template or a canvas or something to fill in, you can ask all sorts of questions that you would otherwise be misinterpreted.
Mm.